Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. We're excited to share the love for our favorite stories. This season, we took a short break from fantasy shows to share with you our love for another genre. And now, we're returning to that genre with a show that is both a period piece and a fantasy show. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul, and our returning listeners will know that we're cousins who started this podcast because we love to talk about fantasy and sci-fi shows. In the past, we've covered His Dark Materials, The Witcher, Avatar The Last Airbender, The Legend of Korra, and Lovecraft Country, and we've loved every minute of it.
We've had a lot of fun covering some of the biggest period pieces in historical dramas, including Bridgerton, The Gilded Age, and Downton Abbey. Last time we talked about The Crown, and this week we invited our friend and a Kinfolk Lore contributor to talk about another show, Outlander, the Starz mega hit. We're focusing our coverage mostly on the first three seasons of Outlander, but please take note, there's some very heavy topics in these seasons, including sexual violence, so take care. Additionally, there might be some light spoilers for the later seasons and even the books.
Mark me, Kinfolk Lore will have adult content. So if you're here for turtle soup-infused boat sex while the chef listens in to see if you want a second helping, you have come to the right place. Let's go! Going through the stones! Let's go!
All right, so season one primarily introduces us to our protagonists, Claire Beecham Randall, a World War II-era combat nurse, and Jamie Mackenzie Fraser, a 18th-century Highlander. Normal protagonist.
Normal
no
stuff.
Big deal.
No, not, yeah, nothing. Nothing like out of the ordinary.
Separated by, you know, a couple centuries. No big deal. While on a second honeymoon with her husband Frank after the war, Claire accidentally travels through time at the ancient stones of Craignadoon. She ends up in 1743, just a few years before the epic conflict at Culloden that changed the fate of Scotland forever. After multiple run-ins with her husband's ancestor, who looks exactly like her husband, like is literally played by the same actor, a British soldier known as Black Jack Randall, she eventually has to marry a Scottish citizen. And it's real rough because he is not at all hot. No, he's gorgeous. Okay? His name is James Mackenzie Fraser. Minor problem. Minor issue. He also has a price on his head and is a fugitive from the Redcoats. No big deal.
And mortal enemies to her husband in the future's like ancestor. Like mortal enemies.
Oh, yeah,
with
yeah,
that
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he has a little some history with Blackjack. So just like small things. They can overcome it with love.
Yeah. And they try. They do. And they push forward into season two, which takes the Frasers to France after barely escaping death, right? I mean, like, it was really, really rough stuff. We'll talk about it. We'll get into it. Where they hope to go to France and stop the bloodshed at the Battle of Culloden by sabotaging the Jacobite campaign of Prince Charles Stuart. This adventure comes at a great cost to both of them. Jamie is still recovering from the trauma he endured at the end of season one, and Claire nearly dies in childbirth. Their daughter named Faith is stillborn. Rough season. Like, I literally almost stopped the show during this season multiple times. You two can attest. After this horrible ordeal, they head back to Scotland and prepare for the battle. Believing that Jamie will not survive the battle, and because she is expecting again, Claire goes back through the stones to present day.
In season three, a lot of time is covered. We can't possibly summarize it. It's basically 20 years of time. But Claire, with the help of Brianna and a family friend, Roger, discovers that Jamie survived Culloden and is alive in the 1760s. So she travels back through the stones to reunite with him. And of course, because this is Outlander, that kicks off like a crazy adventure where they travel across the Atlantic Ocean to the West Indies and then America. It includes not one, but two shipwrecks.
Second shipwreck!
And we also learned, you know, what transpired in the years since they've been separated. Jamie had a son, which he can't claim. He got remarried. We will definitely talk about that because I have a lot to say. And Claire became a doctor and really struggled with her relationship with Frank in Boston because he's the worst.
Sauce, like super struggle sauce. Like her hair went gray. She was depressed. She had no friends other than her one doctor friend. It was fucking horrible.
It was. Jamie had the rougher go here, but Claire didn't have it super easy either.
Yeah, for sure.
By the end of season three, they have landed in the American colonies just in time for another war.
Oh, God.
A couple years before a different conflict.
So, without further ado, let's introduce Kin Folklore contributor, our dear friend, who we hope will stick around on the pod longer than Geneva stuck around in the show. Okay?
She's
here and then she went. She came and then she went. That was it. That quickly. Yes. Wow. In multiple ways. You can think about that in multiple ways. She came and she went. Anyway, to introduce to the show our dear friend, Sloan. Welcome to the show.
Hey guys. Thanks so much for having me back.
Yeah, we're happy to have you back. So talk to us a little bit. Give us a little, I know you're a big fan of the show. So let's talk about, like, kind of give an overview of, you know, what you like about it, things that kind of stand out. I know you've also read the books. So, like, let's talk a little bit about that, like, giving context to some people who are just coming to this or not quite that deep into the world.
Yeah, so there's a lot of content here. And this is another one of these where I, like, watched the first season and then fell off the deep end and read all the books. So this is the show's been running for 6 seasons. There's now 9 full-length books plus 13 novellas and short stories. And the first 3 seasons are based on the first 3 books, which are called Outlander, Dragonfly in Amber, and Voyager. And they were released in the early 90s. And the show's a little bit like Thrones in that the first few seasons are a pretty straightforward adaptation of the books. And then the books get longer and more complicated. And the show diverges more from the books and they end up being a little bit more separate. So part of why we're talking about the beginning today is because that's a little bit narrower. And it's sort of possible to, as long as your tolerance for mortal peril is relatively high, to like roll with the first 3 seasons, even if you're not super in on the world. After second.
No, my tolerance for mortal peril is super high. And this is terrible. I mean, I saw things like, I thought it was like season 2 was like spending the whole season with Ramsay Bolton torturing you. Like, it literally was the whole, it was like, let's have the whole season of just torture. And I was like, geez, come on guys, let up, like a little bit, just a tiny bit.
Yeah, anyway, no, yeah. The sadness tolerance and the mortal peril tolerance required are like quite high. But if you're still, if you're still in at that point, the sort of later 3 seasons and the later books tell a much more expansive story. And the first 3 seasons and books are really about kind of whether these 2 people who were thrown together by circumstance and accidentally both being 2 of the most attractive people God's ever seen to fit to walk the earth, you know, can build some kind of life against all these obstacles. So the show premiered in 2014, which was after, I believe, 5 of the 9 books had come out. And the 7th season is currently in production. We had like a short season 6 and they've promised a very long season 7 as a result. So waiting for that sometime in, I think, early 2023.
I like it. I dig it. I am not that far in yet. I'm new to this whole thing. As you guys saw, I literally live text them every single episode. It was kind of fun and kind of scary. Many times I was encouraged after saying, holy shit, what the fuck just happened? How did that happen? So it was crazy.
And that's a pretty common reaction. I feel like when I first read the books and watched the show, I think Andrea will confirm, I texted her like most mornings being like, can you believe this wild thing happened and what I read last night? I have not live tweeted my like non sequitur reactions to what happened in the later books, but you know, maybe someday.
Oh my gosh. I mean, so the books have a big following. She's obviously prolific as a writer. Unlike her friend, George R.R. Well, George R.R. is prolific. Let me not.
I was about to say, the man has written a cookbook.
he is
about
prolific,
the food
but he's written
in
the...
Westeros. Come on.
No, he's very good at writing and being prolific in the amount that he writes. He's very bad at task prioritization. Okay? We need the fucking Winds of Winter, to which she also needs it, because she wrote the chapter, a chapter, right, that said it, the name, she named the Winds of Winter, and they're good friends. Is this accurate?
Yes. No, it was a total troll job, worthy of him, really. But I got a good chuckle out of that when the last book came out this past November. It's like, she couldn't.
I didn't realize
that
they were friends.
Yeah, no, they've been friends for a long time.
It was just like straight up shade, like fan shade. I kind of like that story better. I'm gonna go if it's straight up shade, but
yeah,
it's nice that they're friends, I guess.
I mean, it's cool, but like at some point, all your friends have to stop messing with you about like one is telling you like you kill your characters too much, and the other one is like, hey, dude, finish the book. You know what I mean? Like at some point, don't listen to the fans. Listen to your friends. Your friends are telling you we want content. Anyway, so Andrea, what did you like? Like what works for you? Like what doesn't work for you? Like what was like the things that you like about it?
So when I first came to this show, I was very skeptical because it just sounded weird. I was like, I'm sorry, what? She travels through time to Scotland? Like why?
Totally out.
I was just like, I don't understand.
I was totally out from that point. Like I've been asked, you told me about it. Like I was totally like, a minute, we talked what, maybe an hour about like, man, I can't get into this time travel shit. Like, I don't like it. I don't love it.
Yeah.
Yet and still, I was able to deal with like somebody cutting through time with a knife and a talking panda bear and all of that shit. But for some reason, time travel fucked me.
Yeah. I don't know why that in particular bothered me. My story of coming to this is actually I was stuck in a New York City snowstorm, which is miserable. So you just hunker down and wait for the snow to melt, basically, because you can't go anywhere. And I think at that point, season 2 was currently airing. And so I watched all of season 1 in like 24 hours. I could not look away. And I think the production value and how well it was made was the first thing to pull me in. I was expecting kind of like a silly, like poorly funded story. Cause it's a story that centers on women. Let's face it. Like I was not expecting much from Stars. But I was really impressed with just the acting, the production value, like everything is so solid. And from season 1, from the jump. And then once I knew the story, like I basically couldn't look away. I had to tell every person I knew who would like this story to watch it. I thoroughly enjoyed the first 2 seasons, even though now I look back on season 2 and I'm like, what was going on in my life? Like, what was I watching? Because it's kind of depressing. But at the time, I was probably watching a lot of Game of Thrones, and that might be why I was like, oh, this is fine. But I thoroughly enjoyed the first 2 seasons. I liked season 3, but I have to say season 1 is still like the standout to me.
Yeah, I think season 1 is the best, like especially given how many shows, like even Thrones as an example, seems like so low budget now looking back at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. But this show really like it just nails it early on. And even if you're not that into the content. And I was also super skeptical about it. Although why I thought I was not going to like a show involving like great knitwear and people with accents and like compelling fantasy stories, unclear, but oh well. Yeah. But it's just so, it's so cohesive and it's so tight and the world building is really good and it looks so beautiful that I think it's really easy to get just like completely hooked in on what happens at the beginning.
For sure. I mean, I was kind of in when they were just like going on like historical sightseeing trip after the war, and then it was like, oh, we're in like this tomb where people died and shit is like really bad. You know what we should do? Cunnilingus, let's go! Yeah! I was like, oh shit, really?
That was the Mackenzie Castle, I believe.
Yeah, it was kind of, we're not going to talk about how I feel about these castles. You're really going to trigger me right now because Lollybrock is like, how do you put it? It's like Deepwood Mott.
Oh, wow. That's
that's not nice.
I like Lallybroch. That's mean.
It's not that great. Not that great. It gets better as the seasons go on. And
it's cute and pastoral.
Yeah. I mean, kind of. But then when you come back, and like, even when she comes back in like the future and you're looking, it's like kind of, well, you know, anyway, I have my preference of castles. I'm more of a Winterfell type of guy, or like Storm's End. What the hell? Dragonstone. Yeah, I like Dragonstone.
Fair enough.
You guys are salty.
No, I mean, it's good. I think part of what, and this is, it sort of feels like a bummer to have to say this in 2022, but part of what's so great about the story is it's about like a complex female character who gets to be a three-dimensional person. Mm-hmm. And I have talked extensively on this podcast about my love for Yen. Mm-hmm. But Claire is sort of has a similar quality of she gets to have this relationally full life and be the romantic lead of the story. And then also like, she's a real bozo and people sometimes forgive her, which is what we mostly all want out of life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we could have it while being the most sexually satisfied heroine in the history of modern literature, that would be cool too. But, you know,
goals.
She gets to be a person in all these different ways, and we get to see that, which I really like.
Yeah, I love that. I love that too. And I think that, like, you know, you mentioned Yen, and one of the things that we talked about when you were last year and we were talking about with Yen was, you know, how much we felt like, man, does the showrunner really even like Yen? And obviously the author of the book does a lot more. But in this, I think like the authors and the showrunners really, I mean, it's hard not to. It's really like Claire. Yes, she struggles. Yes, there's things where she messes up. But as the show continues to go on, you mentioned this to me offline, that like you see her growth. And it's clear. It's like, this is obviously it's her story, right? I feel like that watching it. And it's just, you see, I just enjoy her journey, and it's great to see it, the complexity, and come through that lens. So I enjoy it. I agree with you.
And,
I agree with your take.
And she's an extraordinary person, but in mm-hmm. kind of ordinary ways. Like, she is a person who is extremely brave, because I would not at all have fared well in the 18th century. I'm just letting y'all know. I would have went right back through the screens. Listen, I would have looked around. Mm-mm, not for me. But she like manages to often speak up for people and herself. And then she obviously does not take on like the traditional woman's role in that century. But then she comes back and she's like, hey, you know what I want to do? Be the only woman in my medical school class. Mm-hmm. Which is also extraordinary for the time. So I just think that she is, rather than like being a witch or like having magical powers, right? She is extraordinary in these ways that are deeply relatable for women who have big ambition. She's an ambitious character.
Yeah. And she's living a time period that for at least the three of us, you know, is extremely relatable. Not the 18th century, obviously, but she's, you know, living kind of early middle-aged life for a lot of the story. Mm-hmm. And we don't get to see a lot of that in modern fiction. It's kind of people in the ever after stage of life, right? Mm-hmm. Not that it ends happily ever after, right? Because we just seem to be mortal peril on mortal peril. But we do get to see, you know, we get to see them be adults and live, you know, in recognizable kinds of conflicts. So.
And, you know, she has an adult child by season three. So like that, too, I think is something we don't see often is protagonists who have adult children.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. Like, I found that, you know, it's almost like a sense of like you get to grow with this person without so much time in the story going on. You see them in so many different stages of life. But then there's still like, you know, she still goes back through the stones. And then you get like, you know, back to like what we loved in season one and when she first travels through. But it's like interesting because you got like almost like a fast forward to how things turn out. You don't normally see that with characters, the protagonists in any story. Like, but it goes really, really, really fast. Like to like, oh yeah, she's like, you know, in 18th century, comes back, and now she's like, they flash forward to like her as a mom and with an adult child and figuring out college and, you know, what happened after she lost her husband. And I found that to be fascinating. That part of it, of like who she was in that moment too, really shines through in a way that I was engaged in the story mm-hmm. at that point. you know, in the 60s. Because I hated the fucking future timeline. I was like, don't go back to the 40s. Don't go back. Just stay. Don't go back. I don't want to see it. I don't care. I hated it. So, but I love it when she goes back now. So, and then I love it when she comes back to Scotland. Costume design. What do we think about this trench coat of infinite sadness?
No one has ever looked so good being that sad as she does, like standing in front of the stones at Culloden in the season two finale. No, the costume design is amazing. The knitwear, especially the stuff that, so I'm a hand knitting designer in my other life. And, you know, the stuff that's supposed to be handmade looks believably handmade using techniques that were in use at the time. Like, it's just so thoughtful. We have a mutual friend who would tell us that some of the plaids are wrong, which I'm not an expert in Highland tartan, so don't at me on that. But it's just, again, the level of detail and the, you know, the richness of the dresses she wears in France and all this stuff. It just looks, again, so good, and the production values are so high. It's very cool. But yeah, that trench coat is really sad.
And they repeat their clothing in a believable manner. Yeah. You know, like, you watch enough period pieces and you're like, these people really bought a new dress for every day.
Yeah. Right.
But Claire actually is wearing the same clothing for a lot of it. And it's like believable everyday clothing for the time period. It looks lived in. Yeah. Listen, when I saw this show first, the first thing I did was like Google pattern for crochet shawl like Claire's. Like, it's so much of it is just like really beautiful and also a little different from what we typically see. Like, it's not all ballroom stuff, right? It's mostly everyday clothing.
Right. And that's another sort of interesting thing about the story overall is, you know, these people are, especially the Mackenzies and even Jamie, are aristocrats, right? These are not the small folk of Scotland, but we see a lot of the taxmen and the tenants and the crofters, and we see a lot of people who are not all, you know, the Crawleys and not all the Bridgertons, you know, and that's a sort of, it's an interesting thing that's different here. And then of course the Brits are the bad guys, and in 90-something% of popular period dramas, the British aristocracy are the people that we're supposed to identify with and think are cool and think are the heroes. So it's an interesting kind of difference here that we get the Brits are the bad guys and sometimes the really, really bad guys, and that we get some different visions of class than we get in Downton and Bridgerton and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The British folks in this are rough. Even Bonnie Prince Charles is like, sometimes it's tough.
Mark me, Prince Charles was freaking whack. I did not like that guy. Like, he had so many opportunities to like not make the same mistake that, like, they tried to save his ass so many times. He could have chose differently every time, and every time he chose wrong. Every single time. It was like ridiculous.
Yeah, it's really rough right before Culloden when Jamie is trying to give him multiple outs and he just continues to lecture Jamie as if he knows better. And I'm like, dude, you're out as soon as the fighting starts. Like, what is, like, this is, you're talking to someone who's actually gonna fight.
Yeah, he killed everybody. Right. Everybody killed and then bounced. Like, he's like living on an island somewhere. Like, it's not gonna end well for him. But it ended pretty well. I mean, even as bad as it ended, it didn't end on a battlefield, is what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
Right. So, and I have no idea if, like, historically, you know, Charles Stewart was actually as big a bozo as he is on the show, but I admire the show's choice to, like, double down on making him just absolutely intolerable every time he's on screen. Because it makes a slightly wild plot line, like, a little more engaging and believable.
There's only one guy that was worse, and that's the guy who got his head cut off by my boy Murtaugh. That guy, I kept saying he feels like the Cowardly Lion, but like in real life, like, you know what I mean? Like, that, what was his name again? The Duke
of Sandringham.
Duke of Sandringham. Not like very well acted role, though. Like, he was fun to watch on screen, but I just couldn't. I was like, can somebody please kill this guy? And then Murtaugh obliged. I was very happy.
When he died, I was actually quite shocked. I was like, what is this, what we're doing now?
That's another thing I think the show does well. Like, there's a couple of deaths, right? Where like I mean, we haven't gotten to her yet, but like there's like a couple of deaths where it happens so suddenly. Like Galus's death is like still, it's so sudden. It's like it doesn't make it like, it's not dramatic and like drawn out. It's like, oh wow, that just happened that quick. Okay. You know, that's, and I thought they do that really well in actuality.
Yeah, she gets a quick death, and so does he, and then our other kind of big bad gets like the slowest, most painful series of non-deaths until he finally kicks the bucket at the Battle of Culloden. But the number of times we don't kill Jack Randall.
We don't even get to see this trash motherfucker die for real. Like, we don't really, we just see him roll over and get pushed off because he died. But it wasn't like the way I wanted him to go. Like, I really wanted him to go. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. He's not my favorite. And I don't think I'll ever see him as Edmure Tully the same way again.
No.
Well, Edmure Tully isn't exactly like some amazing character.
No, he sucks, but he really does suck. But I'm just saying, I'll every time I look at him, like, or even in The Crown, whenever you see this guy, it's like, man, you're Jack Randall now.
Forever. Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
No, it's really, it has really made him unwatchable in other things.
Yeah.
No, and there's a number of other kind of tropes the show plays with in interesting ways. And, you know, I won't use the S word subversion, but, you know, because then we'd be in Scary Thrones territory. But, you know, this sort of trope about an arranged marriage of two people who are sort of forced together by circumstance is really popular in lots of romance fiction, particularly in kind of pulpier stories. But this book, you know, and the show aspires to, I think, a kind of higher level of seriousness. And whether or not it gets there is another separate question. But this is a really interesting take on that story structure in, you know, they're not just different classes or different, you know, different sets of parents. They're from 200 years apart, right? And they have to figure out how to mesh these things. So that's another kind of cool part about the show.
How does it differ in a lot of ways to some of the other things we've covered, Andrea? Like, what is your thoughts on that? Like, what are some of the differences you see, like between this and like some of the other period pieces most recently that we've covered?
I mean, aside from Bridgerton, I think this one has probably the most sex, which is a pull for a lot of people. Like, a lot of people. I mean, I think there's like a large contingent of people who read romance novels and they just don't get adaptations.
Yeah.
You know, we just don't, it doesn't really happen because those novels are not taken seriously. And I think the fact that this is so high quality, but it doesn't, I mean, obviously they do actually pull back on the sex a little bit, but not right away. I think that's part of the reason it stands out. I think there's some other things too that are really interesting about what the show and the books try to do. But I think what's, to me, the focus on Claire through the stages of her life are something we don't actually get to see that often. Because, like, if we look at some of the period pieces that are ongoing, the protagonist shifts to the younger unmarried protagonist. Like, that's Bridgerton,
right? Because you're still in that marriage plot, right? Where the fundamental part of the story is about who is the protagonist going to marry, whereas this is really about what happens after, right? The marriage takes place in episode 7 of season 1, and we're now 75 hours of television later.
And it introduces new characters, but the focus still remains on Jamie and Claire and their immediate family. And I think one of the things that I admire about this show is that they get you to love new characters so quickly.
Yeah.
Like, within 10 minutes of meeting young Ian, I was ready to die. I was like, we are going to protect young Ian no matter what, James Frazier. Yeah. You better protect his life. And I, like, it's, and Fergus is, like, probably my favorite character that I complain about the least. Like, he's just, they're just immediately, like, endeared to you. And even though they don't always make the right decision, even though they're not perfect, like, I think it's a testament to Diana's writing that she makes characters who are lovable but deeply flawed.
Yeah, I think like, thinking about what you're saying about the characters, I also like that they reintroduce characters throughout the story that you may that you don't see them for episodes and episodes, and then they come back in. And I mean, like, outside of like Atla or Thrones, I mean, there's other stories that do this, right? But these two really stand out to me a lot. Like, I, that we've covered, that, well, one that we've covered and one we will cover. It kind of makes it just, I feel really good about that. Like, they like keep bringing people back. Like, you know, when John Grey comes back, when, you know, they introduce these characters in moments where you think, oh, that's kind of inconsequential. Like, okay, there was a cutthroat that they, like, you know, fooled and he gets out. But he actually ends up being a very pivotal character in Jamie and Claire's life. And that's, I think it's cool that they do that. You know what I mean? That's really, really interesting.
Yeah. And she's really, she's shockingly good at that in the books of, you know, the, so the ninth book came out this fall, and the number of things that I was like, sure, were going nowhere in the earlier books that came back, and loops that she closed. So she's just very, I mean, she will, you know, use multiple shipwrecks to write her way out of conflict, but she does manage to like tie it together in a way that's pretty impressive. The exception to the instant lovability is Roger and Brianna that we're going to have to talk about.
Well, let's start with Roger and Brianna. We're going to talk about characters. Why don't we start with Roger and Bree? Like, let's talk about it.
Yeah, Roger joins the books by leering at the woman who's going to become, you know, a central figure in his life and the mother of the girl he likes, which is not a great look for him.
Oh, what? He's like checking out. You're talking about checking
out.
Yeah,
he's like checking out Claire on a boat. And you're like, really now?
they cleaned that up in the show. All right, there you go.
So right. Roger Wakefield is the son of the Reverend who is hosting Frank and Claire at the beginning of the first season. And we see him a little bit in season two as a little kid, because he's actually the adopted nephew of the Reverend. And then he... you know, after his adoptive father dies, we meet him again as an adult. He's quite taken with Bree instantly, despite Bree being, I think, like 11 years his junior, if we actually do the math.
Really?
Yeah.
They did a good job in Bree's the casting.
Like, yeah, think, he like has tenure at Oxford. I think Bree is like 19.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like 19 and he's a professor, which I was like, red flag, Frank, yeah. Like. Because isn't Frank also significantly older
than
Claire? He is,
but Diana's like really bad at math, so the timeline is like a little hard to line up. and she's admitted that, so, you know, that's cool. But in
at least she didn't forget somebody's birthday on the show.
True.
Like, in her books, you know, like, I mean, poor Will. Poor Will. that's all I got to say. Anyway, Stranger Things, shout out. Go ahead, continue.
But in a story of characters who are all like pretty serious survivors, Brianna and Roger are the most kind of obviously useless in terms of their ability to get themselves out of bad situations. And I think in Roger's case, the actor Richard Rankin, who plays him, is very charming, which covers like a multitude of sins. But unfortunately, Sophie Skelton, who plays Brianna, is like the one not charming person in this cast. And you feel that because she just doesn't, the performance doesn't quite feel like lived in the way that some of the other people around her are. And so I think that intensifies the feeling of like, oh, what's going on here? And how did like the child of two people who are so capable, because even though Jamie makes a lot of moronic decisions, but he's like good at carrying them out. Right. Yeah. Could turn out to be kind of so bad at taking care of herself. It's a little bit of a puzzle. But and
she's very whiny in the show. Like, just sometimes I'm just like, stop your whinging. Like, I don't understand what you're doing.
Right. Like, your mother survived a placental abruption in 1745. And you're like, you know, man, I can't dry my hair. Like, come on.
She's a lot. I said that the very first time I saw both of them. I was like, man, they're a lot. Like legit, they're a lot. And I just, you know, like, I had this whole time travel thing, so I'm going to drop out of Harvard. Really? Like, that's what we're doing? Like, that's what, I mean, I don't get that. I don't understand why that was the motivation. You don't want to be in Harvard in the first place. Just admit it. Admit it. Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. The season two of the show opens in 1948 with her coming back through the stones, and we get that kind of iconic scene of her stopping the motorist on the road and being like, who won the Battle of Culloden? The book actually opens in 1968 with the stuff we see at the end of season two with Roger and Bree at the Reverend's funeral. That's actually how the book opens, is Brianna and Claire are on this trip to, because she's agreed to Frank's stupid promise that we'll talk about later, that she's never going to take Bree to Scotland or mention her history or whatever. And she takes her there and they go to the Reverend's funeral and they reunite with Roger. And that stuff all happens earlier in the book. So we sort of, we start that stretch of the story knowing that these two kind of grown-up characters exist and are part of Claire's life. And the story is actually told from the perspective of kind of Claire telling Roger and Bree what happened in this era of her life, which is part of why we get a lot of the voiceovers in past tense, because it's taken straight out of the books. But so we know Roger is mm-hmm. there, and Roger is immediately just like drinking whiskey and angling for both of them in a way that's super awkward.
Like, which one will it be? Which one will it be?
Yeah, I mean, and he's equally age-wise positioned between the two of them, right? Because Claire's in her mid-40s and Brianna's 19. So could have gone either way, I mean, but, you know.
I mean, this is an interesting thing you're bringing up, too, about these promises that Claire ends up making to Frank, and Frank kind of pushing her to make them. Let's talk about Frank a little bit. I'm out on the guy. Like, I was pretty early on. Like, you know, like, he gets the This Fucking Guy Award for this show. You know, like many people hear me in this podcast, like, this fucking guy. And that, he gets it. Like, I just feel like he constantly wanted her to deny who she is, what her experiences were, like, and are, to fit into the perception that he holds of her versus just loving the person. And it's only so it could fit into his package of what he wants his life to look like, not like even down to like accepting, you know, Claire and Jamie's child. It's really just about because he always wanted a child and thought he couldn't, more so than like him actually caring about her and her well-being. I don't know, man. I just don't like the guy. What are your thoughts? What are you guys' thoughts?
You will not find me defending.
Yeah, there's Frank no defense of Frank going on around here. And lots of people will say, oh, but he loved Brianna. And it's like, well, you know who else loved her children? Cersei Lannister, right? It's an incredible...
And he's a failure as a man and a failure as a
He mom. Really is. we can just pull from the whole extended kinfolklore canon for insults for Frank. Tobias gives a really wonderful performance, right? And especially the beginning of season two, the last time we saw him is as Randall committing these incredible acts of violence on Jamie. And then we see this moment, this heartbreaking moment where Frank realizes that Claire is pregnant with somebody else's child and then breaks a bunch of precious antiques, mm-hmm. which like not a great move, but okay. But you know, it's a really good performance of a character who's really like kind of a jerk. And even more of one in the books than he is on the show. You know, in the books or in the show, we get some hints of his infidelity and the way he, like, his icky sexism of the way he treats her and how he diminished her ambitions and all this stuff. But in the books, that's even more blatant. So, yeah, I'm out on Frank.
I just want to say the acting is quite extraordinary. There are not many TV shows where people play two separate characters. Mm-hmm. But when it's done well, it is done extremely well. I can really only think of a few examples that I think it's really solid in. And that's, you know, Orphan Black. Obviously, incredible. Many characters are played by the same actress. And then The Vampire Diaries. Like, other than that, I don't think it always works. And sometimes it's kind of silly. And he just nails it. Frank and Jack feel like two extremely different people to me. Yeah. And I think he does a really good job of separating them and also of creating some empathy for Frank, because there are moments where you feel sorry for Frank. I don't feel that sorry for Frank, but, you know, every once in a while I'm like, oh, okay, he's hurting, and that it's hard to watch someone hurting. I would have no problem watching Jack Randall hurting.
No, not at all. Like, Jack Randall is trash. He's a shitty human being.
Yeah.
The worst. I even couldn't feel bad for him when his brother was dying. I was feeling bad for the brother and all that, but I was like, man, you're even a shithead when your brother's asking you to do something. He's the worst. The worst of the worst. Like, not a good dude.
Can we promise to come back to that? I know we're talking about characters, but can we come back to that plot line? Because that was wild.
Yeah.
That plot line is crazy.
Yeah, I have no defense for a lot of the back half of season two, and that's part of it. So we'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah. So what about Jack Randall? Like, how'd you feel when you first met Jack Randall's song?
So I actually think the first time I watched it, I thought, and I continue to think, that first flashback scene that we see with him and Jenny is like a little over the top. And I get that that's part of the world building that we're supposed to see, like, hey, the English are bad. Look, they're really bad. But the later scenes, and particularly the scene in the Garrison Commander episode where he interrogates her, like, it's a terrifying performance. And I think a lot of actors would have just kind of chewed the scenery and been like, look how much I am acting. And he's so restrained, and it seems so easy for him to be that callous and sadistic. And it's really like, it's just a tour de force of a performance, but like, ooh, not a good guy. Yeah. Get him away.
Yeah. Yeah. The performance, again, the acting is great. Like you said, it's not overacted. It's like, even his anger is subtle. And there's moments where he disarms you and makes you feel like, oh, he's going to be decent. And then all of a sudden you see like the switch flip and you're like, holy shit. Like, yeah, he's not Jack Randall is holy shit again. There it is. Holy yeah. shit. That was a lot of holy shit with Jack Randall for sure.
No, and like rewatching the end of season one is really painful. And I did it again for this as we prepped for this. But I think the performance gets scarier on rewatch, even though I was like hiding under the, you know, blanket of televised terror for much of it the first time around. Like it got worse, not better, on further acquaintance.
Yeah, I mean, we'll touch on some of the reasons why some of the themes that make him feel that way, because like, you know, like from the start, like the very first thing, and we'll come back to some other characters, but the very first thing that happens is he literally, when we meet him, he's trying to rape Claire, like right away. Like it wasn't even like 2 seconds, we're like, he's on screen. And it's one of the criticisms I know that we have of the show. One of the things that I think comes up quite a bit is the amount of sexual violence on the show.
Yeah.
And he's one of the biggest perpetrators. One of the many, but one of the biggest perpetrators of this in the show. So I think that's why you can easily see, like, we're out. I mean, I'm out on this guy totally. It's, like, almost even hard to even talk about him. I was happy when he was gone. When they rolled his fucking body over in Culloden, and Jamie could barely speak or utter words, and I knew that he was dead. I was like, is he really dead? Are they going to burn the bodies? Like, what's going to happen? Like, I need to know.
No, and you're like not supposed to root for people to be dead, but the number of times that they like in the madness of mercy fail to kill this guy, it's just like, it's never helps.
Oh, you're not supposed to, but I do. I do on these shows because it's fake. Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I mean, Tywin is not my favorite character in Game of Thrones for no reason. Like, I'm sitting here like, yeah, it's kind of, I do. I root for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've been told I cannot talk about Andrea being evil adjacent anymore because of my love for Tywin, but equally because of the fact that in this whole thing, we don't hate Galus. I mean, she didn't hate Galus. You don't hate Galus. So, I mean, you are still kind of evil adjacent. So can I really not say it anymore? You do kind of love a woman who bathes in virgin blood.
I'm going to side with Paul on this one, Andrea. It's really hard for me, but I think I have to.
Listen, I love the woman's chaotic energy. She's just chaos. Like, she comes on the scene and immediately I'm like, wow, this bitch is going to be crazy. Like, she is just so, I just love it. I don't think she's a good person. I wouldn't hang out with her. You know, I'm a little scared of her, but I just love her energy. She just seems from the beginning like she's going to be nuts. And she's great.
And Galus is a survivor, man. I mean, like, she goes to America and re-enter to the West Indies and then reinvents herself. And, you know, she makes it for a while.
I just don't understand why someone from 1960 whatever is this caught up about fucking the Stuart King. I don't understand. Like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you going through? I know she's a history person and blah, blah, blah.
She's a little bit of a fanatic. I don't know if you noticed.
Yeah.
There's like a tiny, tiny hint of fanaticism in her. I think my favorite part of season 3 is actually when she just can't wrap her head around the fact that Claire is just there, like, because she accidentally went through the stones.
Yeah.
Like, she can't She can't cope with the fact that someone isn't as crazy as her. Like, she just, she can't. And so I enjoy Galus. I think she's a fun character. And okay, fine, whatever. I'll accept it. I'm still evil adjacent. It, whatever.
Well,
it
and she, early in season one, she's actually, like, better at fitting in the 1740s than Claire is initially, right? Like, Claire, she gives Claire some friendly advice about how to make it less obvious that she ain't from around there, you know? And I hope that we, you know, this is light spoilers, but that we will meet other people who have come back on purpose and later on. And I hope that we learn eventually, because the legacy of Galus and what happened to her life while she was back in the 1700s ends up being, you know, matters. So I hope that we will someday find out more about, like, beyond that she believed she had magical powers and she wrote this crazy book about people who had disappeared through the stones, like, what made her decide to take this step quite as dramatically.
I'm pretty sure I think we will 100%. I think there's gonna be, I mean, I'm looking forward to it. I'm still on my journey, so don't, you know, like I could actually, they're actually being kind and not spoiling it for me right now. So I'm still on my journey. I'm still on, my watch has not ended yet.
No. No one's watch ever ends with this show.
It's gonna keep going. How many more seasons do you think they're gonna have?
I don't know. I mean, the books are now substantially ahead of where the show is in time, because I think we're at. There's maybe 5,000 pages of book left to adapt of what's been currently written. Yeah. And at the pace at which these books move, that's like 10,000 pages of normal book plot to attempt to put into television. So we'll see. It'll be interesting.
Well, we'll see. I mean, another person who, like, I want to talk about, or people, the relationship, the McKenzies. Dougal McKenzie and Colm McKenzie. What?
Yeah, take these garbage guys out with the trash. But we have to give a shout out to Graham McTavish, who of course we know as Sigmund Dijkstra from The Witcher, playing a very similar character, right? He's the kind of man behind the curtain, and he's way over his head in a relationship with a woman who might have magical powers. And he's drunk a lot. So he's not talking to a barn owl here, but, you know, the basic concept is still there.
And he's going to be a Kingsguard of in House of Dragons.
Yeah.
He's going to be a Kingsguard as well. So he's, like, you know, literally everywhere. Like, we appreciate him. I like that guy.
Yeah.
I like him as an actor.
Right. No, this is another one of these, like, this is, you know, the 10th time we'll say this, but wonderful actor. Like, wow, this character is awful. Right. When he's, like, telling Claire to agree to marry him when Jamie, like, because he's basically left Jamie to die at the hands of the Redcoats, like, not a great look.
No. Well, which is why it's like the double, like, thrust of the knife through his chest was kind of like, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Like, not that bad. I mean, he had to go. He was going to go tomorrow in Culloden. Might as well go a little early.
Right.
He should go before everybody else. He should have an honorable death.
I felt nothing when Dougal died.
Not at all.
And I felt nothing when Colm died. I was like, hurry up and drink the poison and go. Like, I don't have time for this. I felt nothing. I can't stand either of them. I think initially, because I read the first book after I saw season one. And in fact, some of season two. So I think initially I wasn't entirely out on Dougal. I was waiting for a redemption arc. But it just never comes. He gets worse.
No,
actually,
he does get worse.
I feel like he progressively gets worse.
Yeah.
So I also don't understand why my girl Galus was into him. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't get it either.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a little weird. She had strange taste. I mean, she broke the poor dude in the 60s. He was over here like, what was going on with him? He broke himself. He was sitting up there looking like a hot mess. We were like, man, when he lit up, I was like, it's a mercy. When she lit him up, I was like, listen, it's a mercy. Like, let this guy go.
Yeah. Oh, man. No, and Colm gets, like, a little bit of the you know, his death is, like, there's a little emotional closure with him and Jamie and Claire. But, yeah, no, not great. Not great, the McKenzies.
No.
Here's a fun game that I've been trying to play since I've been rewatching the show. Can you explain in, like, a sentence Roger's relationship to Jamie?
Oh, let's see if I can do it.
How they're actually related. Like, I found myself, I was telling my partner, because he was like, who's this guy? And I was like, well, he's a family friend, but really what's more important is, and then I started talking and I was like, I sound insane, right?
I think he's his nephew, like six times removed. Or no, he's his second, he's his cousin, like six times removed, right? Because Dougal's his uncle. And he's the descendant of Galus and Dougal's son, who we'll meet later. So I think that makes him his cousin, like six generations removed or something.
Okay, that was easy for you.
I think. Well,
I really struggled.
Yeah, I mean, only because we have like weird generational match cousins who I call my nephews, and my mother-in-law says like, no, it's your second cousin once removed or whatever. So,
well, you guys are better than me. Like, I was holding out. You just helped me dispel a theory. I was like, oh yeah, she went through the stones, had the baby, and Roger's actually Dougal and Galus's son. And I was like, and Andrew was like, no. And I was like, oh, okay.
No, Galus never makes it back to the 1960s.
So great. So speaking of, like, actually, one thing I want to say before I go into any other characters, before we move on from Colum. There is a really good line when he's like, when he's about to, before he takes the poison or asks Claire for the poison, when she says, here's like, you know, he's like, you know, killing yourself is a suicide, it's a sin. And he goes, what's one more sin to a sinner? And it also makes me think about a few other lines that lets me know that Outlander, the writing, there's some bars in here, okay? And those bars have translated into Drake. Drake has made a reappearance in our freaking podcast when the guy in the first season gives a toast and he says, I want a long life and a legendary one. Like, this is from like Drake's pop star song. He literally quotes the whole freaking thing and another one. I can't even believe it. I'm just blown away that Drake is quoting Outlander out here in these streets.
This is one of the better things to come out of our like half-assed internet research for this podcast is just covering that Drake watches Outlander.
I mean, I was blown away because I'm sitting on the couch. I'm watching it. The guy starts giving the toast and he's all like, you know, I want a long life, a legendary one. I want a young wife and a pretty one. I want it. And he's like, and I'm sitting here and I'm like, wait, that's from somewhere. And I was like, oh shit, that's a Drake song. Holy shit.
Very much thanks to your daughter, who is a huge Drake fan, who probably made you listen to that song a million times.
I mean, made me in air quotes. Yes, of course. Oh, man. Yeah, no, it was great. And then, one other person with a legendary line is my guy, Murtaugh, who is a fucking G. I lay my vengeance at your feet. Oh man, what a good one! Let's talk about Murtaugh. What do we have to say about this guy? He's the best.
Yeah, the hero of the most death metal episode title of the entire series. The episode is called Vengeance is Mine. Murtaugh is Jaime's godfather, I guess, is I think how they're actually related. And he was one of many people who, like Jaime, his mother was very desirable, apparently, and many people were in love with her, including Murtaugh. He's great. He's, you know, Duncan LaCroix, the actor, just gives such an amazing performance. It's so like he's irascible and crotchety, but he loves Jaime and Claire so much. And that episode where they're on the run looking for him is just like so, it's so charming. And he's so, watching them come to see eye to eye is really great.
Yeah.
I have bad news for you on the what happens to him front. This is the point that Andrea said I was saving, which is that he dies at the Battle of Culloden in the books.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And relatively early. And he and Jaime have a beautiful moment as he's dying how they have this in the middle of the battle is less clear, but you know, that part gets a little atmospheric.
everything is just like murmuring right now. I feel like he died at the Battle of Culloden, and like I can't understand any other words right now. I'm so torn. I'm so upset. He's my guy. Like
I know.
I know. I actually, one of the joys of us bullying you into watching the show has been to see how much you love Murta. Like I love him too.
Yeah.
So the fact that you love him is just, it's been nice to watch.
And every time you're like, why aren't people worried about him? I'm like, Andrea, can I tell him?
I feel like we need to do something. I feel like this is just as a point of distinction and honor. We've talked about many deaths, but as a kin folklore tradition for the good ones, let's pour one out. Pour one out.
Yeah.
For Murtaugh.
No, he deserves it. So
a ride or die. Like this guy literally, when he said, I don't want you dying for nothing, and he turns to Jamie and says, I won't be dying for nothing. I'll be dying with you. Oh man. Oh God.
Yeah.
Like what? Like that is like one of, again, bars. Bars. Let's just put out, I'm gonna take many Outlander bars and I may just make a song.
Go for it.
We did discover there's a musical and a concept album, so we might as well like add to the canon. You know what I mean? Like it is what it is.
Yeah.
Ah, man. So yeah, no, I did have a problem with like where the hell is Myrtle? Like she comes back through the stones and nobody's even asking. I'm like, what? Okay, well now I understand. He's gone. But in the show they send him to the colonies.
Yes.
Okay.
So right. we will not tell you about his fate in the show, but I will say the reason nobody asks about him in the early part of season 3 is that he's supposed to be dead. So
oh
that,
my God.
That's why.
If you have a character with chemistry like that on a TV show who is so beloved by the fan base, you just can't kill them all.
Yeah.
So I can understand why they didn't at Culloden anyway.
Yeah,
so.
But he like went to Branville for season 3 while they figured out what to do. So
what to do. Yeah, they had to figure that out for sure. So do we talk about Fergus? And let's talk about Fergus, man. Fergus and Marsali. I love Fergus from the beginning. I like them both. I don't know her well enough yet, but I really do like her so far. At first I was like out, like in the first time we meet her.
Yeah.
But now I'm warming up. But like Fergus, man, I mean, from a little kid all the way to now, like he loses his hand. He's like, well, now it would be a man of leisure. It's really, really adorable. I mean, like, he's like always has a sunny disposition, even when something terrible's happening.
Yeah. And they're
super smart.
Yeah. And his relationship with Jamie, like shows us so much of what's special about Jamie as a person and his just like capacity to bond with people. Cause he meets Fergus, like, literally on the street trying to pickpocket him and is like, hi Claire, I adopted this little boy, you know, like,
yeah.
And yeah. And very much thinks of him, you know, as much as he does the, you know, children of his own body. So it's just such a cool little insight to get to see. And yeah, that the both characters get to really grow up in the later seasons and end up being really cool parts of Claire and Jamie's lives. So should we talk about Mr. Fraser Senior?
I was just about to say, man of peace.
Yes.
You guys say.
So
why do you guys always say man of peace? Like, why is he a man of peace? Okay. Let's start there.
So in the, obviously there's this infamous scene in season 1 where he decides to be rather punitive with his new wife over her misdeeds. And when he is describing, when they're sort of in the process of reconciling, he says something about like, you know, I rarely lose my temper, Sassenach, and I don't make idle threats, I think is the quote. And, you know, he then will go on to lose his temper at a huge range of people, sometimes violently and sometimes just with words, including, you know, his wife, his best friend, his uncle, who he outright kills. Yeah, you know, I mean, like, the list of people is quite long. But he repeatedly insists that he never loses his temper and that he's a very mild-mannered guy. So, some time ago, we started calling him James Fraser, Man of Peace, and that has kind of just stuck.
I like it. I think it's now it makes totally in context. This is good stuff. I love it. Yes. All right.
One of the problems I have with Jamie is when Claire comes back from seeing Colm, he lectures her about assisted suicide, basically.
Yeah.
And then a few minutes later, murders Dougal.
Who did not want to die. He did not want to go.
This is Jamie right here. Like, Claire did something that she thought about. It was like extremely thoughtful. She thought she was doing Colm, you know, a kindness. And Jamie just murders Dougal within minutes on the show. It felt like, I was like, wow, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Man of peace, he strikes again.
And he is, you know, again, he's like our moral center in lots of ways. And he's the good guy. He's the hero of the story. But like, he is an unrepentant criminal.
That's what I'm saying. I was like, who's our moral center? This guy is a criminal through and through. Like, what are we talking about? We love him, but we have to know, like, I'm not like taking life advice from him. Like, if somebody's like, hey, like, because if it's like, hey, there's like this total legal way for us to make money, and then there's like this other way that's like criminal and will make us possibly get hung, he's picking the latter every time.
Every time.
Involving
the young people in his charge.
Yes.
Listen, that was the first thing I text you both. I was like, wait a second. He goes through all of this, the Battle of Culloden, can't see his kid, sires another child, has to give it, leaves him behind, gets his freedom, and of all the choices he could have made, he chooses crime.
Yes.
All the choices.
Literally, the minute he gets out of prison and is released, or after he's released on parole from Hellwater, he's like, yeah, sure.
Oh, God.
And then he, like, I mean, there's maybe some currency conversion issues going on, but at least in the books, the alimony that he agrees to from a woman that he could not be married to because he had a living wife, let's review, is worth, like several times the value of the price on his head in season one.
And just for the record, why didn't they come up with that whole point of emphasis in the beginning when they were going back to the stones? Okay, what I'm going to tell people is I put you on a boat to the colonies. Like, if that was going to be their story, then he could have stayed away from getting married ever again. He's like, my wife is alive, she's on a boat, she went to the colonies.
Right. No, there would have been a million possible ways to explain this if like anybody thought about anything for more than 3 seconds ahead of time, but like, that's not how this rolls.
Yeah,
100%. So 100%. In season three, during this 20-year gap, after he comes back from being in Ardsmuir prison and then being paroled at Hellwater on his adventures with John Grey, which we'll talk about, we'll tease more later because those are in the spinoff books. But he, at his sister's behest, in Jenny Murray's absolute worst decision in the history of ever, he marries Leary McKenzie. And... Or I guess she's Leary McKimmy at that point. She's been married twice. She has two grown children. And he doesn't tell Claire this immediately because he's so happy to see her. And one of the very funniest moments, Paul, of our journey together here was when you were like, I feel like he's hiding something. Causing Andrea and I to spit a great deal of coffee and whiskey across various surfaces in amusement. But, you know, and then we get this whole process of there's a very funny and quite explicit recognition scene about how we find out about this. And then they have to try to figure out what to do. And that's what sets us off on the journey that animates kind of the second act of the story, right? Or third act, yeah. Or I don't know what act we're on. But having to try to get this treasure to pay off Leary is what gets young Ian taken, which is what gets them to the West Indies, which is what gets them to America, which is what sort of moves the plot forward.
I actually, as much as I dislike Leary, I got to tell you, I didn't feel bad when he got kept because I knew he wasn't going to die. Like, when she shot him, I was kind of like... his karma's a bitch. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it kind of happened for a reason. It's like he got shot because he could have been honest from the beginning. He gives that whole story. I didn't want to lose you. I didn't want you to turn around and go. Yeah, because you know you shouldn't be fucking with Leary. She tried to get her burned alive.
Right. And this is one of the major book to show changes. That's a little bit of, it seems like not a big deal, but it makes it weirder. Is like, in the books, he has no idea that Leary is responsible for the witch trial.
Okay.
So at least he doesn't knowingly accidentally marry the woman who almost got his wife burned alive.
Yeah, I'm saying, if you try to burn my wife alive, even if she goes back through the stones, we're enemies, like, from jump. Like, it just is what it is. We're never going to be cool, like, ever. You know what I mean? Like, that's it.
I would have to be pretty low in my life. I would have to be
pretty low. And he is. I mean, he's full Grizzly Adams at this point. Yeah. But,
like, I would need to be pretty upset with the way my life turned out to marry Leary. Like, that, she is... I just don't understand. I kind of get it in the way that this show sets it up with the kids. Because, you know, one thing that is pretty tragic about Jamie is, aside from Fergus, he hasn't really had that much parenting experience. He hasn't had the joy of spending time with his children in the same way that most parents would get. And even with Fergus, he separated from him for quite a long time. So I get it with why he would want the stepdaughters. What I don't understand is, find another woman who's a widow. Lots of people died at Culloden. There's got to be somebody else who has kids that you can compare it. Why Leary? I just don't get it. Yeah. I just hate Leary. She's on the top of my...
She's not... I mean, we can't say the worst because of the curve we're grading on her, but, like, it's a mess.
And then
Jamie makes one other, of course, like, really terrible and not fully consensual decision with Geneva Dunsany,
it wasn't consensual for hit for like she wanted she made him so it wasn't consensual on his part.
It's bad. I mean, he's an indentured servant.
It's bad.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah. No, it's wildly exploitative and non-consensual by modern standards, and of course, because this is just the kind of luck he has. She gets pregnant.
And
William
falls in love. Like, why did she fall in love? Like, really that quick? Like, that was it? He was like, that was like, I literally spit something out of my mouth. And she was like, I love you. And he was all like, no, you don't love me. That's not what this is. I was like, yo, are you serious right now? What is happening in this show? This is way too quick. What's happening?
I mean, apparently he's that good in bed, but, you know.
Claire taught him well. Claire taught him well.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
She did. Among the funnier lines in the book that we don't get in the show is her saying that he made love with a kind of unflagging joy that made her think that male virginity was a seriously underrated commodity.
Wow. Well,
so done. That's there.
Well done, Diana. Good job, Diana. Wow. Well written. Oh, my gosh. And then I guess we've spoken a lot about Claire, but do you want any notes we want to, like, talk about, like, to kind of, like, close out her as, like, when we talk about the characters?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about kind of it's fun and a cool part of the story that even though she's our romantic heroine and our POV character, like, she does some really dumb stuff. And some of it is so cringy that I have actually not successfully watched it any of the times because I knew how cringy it was in the book.
Mm.
But I think it's fun on rewatch. You know, look, the show came out a long time ago. The first 6 books had been written by then, I think. So most people who are watching it based on anything other than the Netflix thumbnail image, which right now, unfortunately, is of Roger, kind of have some notion of how this question of which timeline she'll end up in resolves, right? And it seems obvious to us that that's where it's going. But I think they actually do a really good job in the first season of making her seem genuinely torn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we all are like, Frank's a wet noodle. And oh, gosh, what a terrible thing it is to be married to this attractive and sexually satisfying Scottish aristocrat. What a hard life. But she actually, you know, she seems torn in a way that I think is compelling. And it's really fun that we get to watch her grow up kind of over the ensuing years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. So we've talked a lot about, like, what works, what we like, different things that didn't work, but let's just like touch on real quickly, like, some of the stuff that didn't work. We kind of did already talk about you know, the sexual violence piece, so we don't have to belabor talk more about it unless you have more things you want to say. But, like, let's just talk about some of the things that we didn't like about the show.
I mean, I think Sloan and I have talked quite a bit about this over the last few days, but I think that the show does something that I actually appreciate, and the books do this too, where it's not erasing people of color. Like, we exist.
Yeah.
But how we're represented on screen is hard. I mean, it is so cringy in season 3 when Mr. Willoughby, like, I know that his portrayal in the book is 10 times worse, actually, because I remember reading it and being and actually calling my friend Angie, who had read the books like a little ahead of me, and being like, why didn't you warn me about this? It's pretty awful. And the show, I think, does like a slightly better job with him. But the stuff in the West Indies is really hard to watch. Like, it is
very,
it is just so frustrating. Okay. I think most of our listeners know at this point, we, Paul and I are descendants of Jamaicans, right? So it's like this scene in the slave market auction is just, I know they were trying to demonstrate like the cruelty, but you have to like actually make, you know, the enslaved people full people before you do that to them on screen. I did not need to see that. I never want to see it again. Like, it kind of snuck up on me this time, and it doesn't age well. It aged really poorly with Claire being like the white savior of the moment. It just, it ages. It, I think I watched this the year it came out. It looks even worse now. I do want to just say that I do think that the show made more of an effort. The showrunners made more of an effort in season four to be more representative, and also to bring in people into the writer's room. But I just, this, I think for me, this is actually like the biggest cringe moment, aside from the, you know, ongoing sexual violence that we just can seemingly never escape. In this story, like, it is, it was, it's really hard to watch. I tried to warn you, Paul, but I don't know if there's any real warning for it, you know, like, it just is, it is what it is.
No, I had to, I had like literally paused it at like you did give me fair warning. And then I like was chatting you guys, and then I paused it and like was like, I'm going to go to the store. I got to run an errand anyway, just to give myself a minute to like cool down and be like, okay, it is what it is. But the initial shock of it, especially like in context, it, like Andrew just said, especially in the sense that it's in like, you know, our lineage is from there, from the place that they're showing and depicting, right? So it's like to feel that and be like, you know, in that way was and honestly, another piece of it is that that there's also some Scottish heritage as well, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, man, it's part of like our familial story that that happened. So it's but it's hard to see visually. And then I would say the other piece of it for me that I spoke to both of you about a little bit was I thought they did something interesting. I thought they had a moment of clarity in like the spiritual representation, where there was like, you see where Claire has this moment where she sees, you know, the women dancing in the stones by the stones. And then she also sees the Jamaican people dancing in a traditional ceremony. And a lot of what's being represented there to people who listen to our Lovecraft coverage is a lot of what we even talked about when they were talking about what people call Obia, Santeria, Ifa. But it's covered in such an outsider's kind of way that it looks like it's like touched like, ooh, paganism is bad and these people do this. When in actuality, there's like some beauty in the spiritual practice, mm-hmm. the same as the people who read the leaves and kind of what it is. So the idea that these people, that the people who are doing this service would see this man, the brother of the seer, die and then just start knifing him is totally absurd, mm-hmm. in like a way that doesn't make any sense in context to it. There were some parts of the ceremony that make sense, but that was one of the ones that really stood out to me as like, okay, this is somebody who did not do the work of bringing people who have that spiritual practice or that understanding, or like even in proximity to, into the writer's room to understand what's going on. Where in context, you can see in Lovecraft, there was a lot of context and also connection to the actual spiritual representation. So to me, this was a big miss for me, because I was just like, oh, and the Savage's comments were like big misses for me. That being said, it, you know, I always love seeing Jamaica in any sort of like, you know, like screen adaptation. I'm like, oh wow, yes, our, you know, but I would have liked to see that actually just removed from the whole thing, because I didn't think it really added anything to the story. Like, for example, what was going on? Can you guys please? I laughed, like literally laughed. What was going on with the Jamaican people that were humming with torches that just passed by the carriage that made them stop, and then nothing? Like, what happened? What was that about?
I don't even remember this. Yeah, I don't even
remember.
It was
so random. It was the most random. I was like, this is so random. What is happening to this? Anyway, that's my take on it.
You know, look, you have choices when you adapt things, right? And there is, look, there is stuff in the source material here on a number of fronts that's quite troubling. And the show has choices about how it adapts that stuff. And I think part of what strikes all of us as so troubling about that is, you know, they've written around other things mm-hmm. that seemed unacceptable by the time the show was adapted. And like, they just should have been more thoughtful, or maybe it's a different people in the room fixes it, but it seems a little like, where was the editing?
Yeah.
Why didn't somebody think like, maybe we shouldn't?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. So it looks like, you know, man, we could go on a lot of directions here, but let's just set our closing thoughts and kind of like, you know, if anybody has any last thoughts just in general that like really stick out that they want to cover, and then we have an announcement, and that'll be end of our period piece season.
I think this is with one people should give a shot to, and I think again there it's not perfect, and there is some stuff in here that is hard for people, but I think the quality of the show overall and the depth we get with these characters is something that's really quite special and fun. And if you're just in it to look at Sam Heughan's abs, that's cool. That's a totally valid way to go on this journey. But I think this is one where there is more here than I think a lot of people give it credit for. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm really glad I like did the thing I always do, which is fall way off the deep end of it. But it's just been it's a fun ride. So I think if you can deal with the time travel and you can deal with a little light fantasy mixed in with your period pieces, which I think everybody here is up for, it's a good ride.
What about you, Andrea?
I totally agree with that. I think that this is a vastly underrated show. I think I understand why people bypass it, because I did it first, right? But it's really good. Like it has its moments where I'm like, why are we doing this? Why is Claire doing this? What is Jamie up to? But I love these characters. I love the family that they've built. Some of it is real family, some of it is found family. I think it's a really well acted, well done show. And I'm glad that I gave it that shot when I had, you know, nowhere else to go in a snowstorm. It definitely was something I was sucked into right away, and I have not regretted recommending it to anyone. Like, I don't think anyone's ever come back and been like, this is a complete waste of time. I think most people appreciate parts of it, even if they don't appreciate all of it. So I completely agree with Sloan.
Well, Sloan and Andrea, I am thankful to you both. That's my take, because I would not watch this show. I would not have watched this show. You guys, you were both like, you have to watch this. And we were talking about our period piece covers. Andrea put it on the list, and I was like, I'm not watching 6 seasons. And then you, thankfully, luckily, were like, no, watch 3, and we'll cover 3. And I am literally going to, like, we're going to stop recording. I'm going to get up from my podcast setup, and I'm going to go watch the first episode of season 4. So that's what's gonna happen, and I love it. It has been a good ride. I've enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of it. To close out, we're not gonna talk about crossover content, but there is a crossover to this show and what we will be covering next. House Tully was represented in here. And it will also be represented very well in the show that we'll be covering next, which I don't think is much of a secret at this point, but we will be covering House of the Dragon. So we'll take a short hiatus, prepare, and get ready for to see Daenerys' family story, which is kind of dysfunctional and fucked up, but it's going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. I'm a little bit nervous about it. I mean, I think we're going to do an episode where we process our trauma from season 8.
Yeah.
But I have to say, as a person who was like, oh, I guess we'll cover it, I just need one trailer. I'm in. I saw the trailer. I was like, okay, we're doing this. Let's go back. Give me the dragons. I need to see the dragons.
dragons all day in our like almost inject them in our veins, as you said yesterday. Inject the dragons. Oh man, yes. So we're excited. Sloan, thank you so much for joining us again. It's always fun to have you on the show. Really, really appreciate it and all your insights about the show. And the journey continues. I will be texting you guys incessantly about the show.
Thanks so much for having me again, guys. It's a blast.
All right. Until next time, you know, go ahead and leave those 5-star reviews and hit us up on all of our social channels, emails, Kid Folklore Pod on both Twitter and Instagram. And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.